Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. Please visit supchina.com, download our smartphone app, or subscribe to our daily email to stay on top of news from China and enjoy a growing selection of originally reported stories and videos. Make sure to check out our new SupChina Red Paper. This 25-page report features all original content on the most important news about China in 2017, from Mar-a-Lago to TPP, the 19th Party Congress, Liu Xiaobo, North Korea, Guo Wengui, AI, the ongoing anti-corruption drive, Tencent's terrific year, the Paris Agreement, and much, much, much more. So take a look ahead at what promises to be a very eventful and momentous 2018 and remind yourself of what happened in 2017. It is a steal at just $8, $8.88. Find it at supchina.com. I'm Kaiser Guo, joining you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. Joining me, of course, from Nashville, Tennessee, is a guy who's like, 真聪明. He's a 稳定的天才. And he goes by the name of Jimmy, Jeremy Goldcorn. You 稳定的天才. Greet the people there, yeah, Jeremy.
Make Tennessee great again is my slogan.
I hear it's a shithole.
非常稳定的. 非常稳定的天才. But thank you for that introduction.
He's just the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
He really is.
Your people.
Anyway, the Associated Press has just been killing it with a series of fascinating and very worrying reporting on Xinjiang and the Uyghurs. It's called China's Uyghurs on Edge. Since mid-December, Beijing-based reporter Jerry Shi has published four outstanding pieces reported not only in Xinjiang, but also in Turkey, in Istanbul and Kayseri and the Syrian border area. Jerry joins us today from the AP offices in Beijing. Jerry Shi, welcome to Seneca.
Hey, thanks a lot, Kaiser and Jeremy. Great to talk to you guys.
Yeah, finally, we John. Jerry, you've actually been writing quite a bit on Xinjiang long before this series actually started, including some reporting about Uyghurs fighting in Syria in a piece that ran back in April. But give us a sense for the impetus behind this series of stories that you did that ran, I guess, mainly in December.
And Jerry, for those of us, for those of our listeners who haven't actually read the series, could you maybe summarize the four recent pieces, what they were about and where they were reported from? And when you did your reporting and all that?
Sure. So the four pieces, there was a couple of components. The first story that ran was actually the last one that was reported. It was out of Xinjiang. I made a trip in late October, early November to basically see what the security situation is like now on the ground. And the general thrust of the story is that policing levels and the methods have basically exceeded what we've seen basically anywhere else in the world in recent history.
Yeah.
And what that really feels like for the people living on the ground who sort of live in this kind of constant state of uncertainty and some would say fear in the name of counterterror. There were other stories that were reported earlier this year. I made a trip to Turkey actually as far back as August to speak to some of the militants who had come back from Syria to get an idea of, you know, what it's like, you know, who are these people, what drives them, and also to talk to some of the Uyghur community leaders, because there's a massive Uyghur expatriate community there in Turkey, and just, you know, I think for the first time, get a sense of what the conversation is like within the Uyghur community, because it's just something that we never get access to as reporters here inside mainland China, given the conditions that we work under.
So that would have been shortly after the fall of Raqqa then, back in August. So I guess they'd all come back from the war then?
Yeah. So actually, the Islamic State and its kind of activities in Raqqa were not actually the focus of my reporting. So the majority of the fighters that I had spoken to joined the Turkestan Islamic Party, which was based out of Idlib, And so that battle is actually raging as we speak this week.
I see it's still going on. Okay, great. But let's start with the stories that focus on Xinjiang itself. You're reporting, as you say, from southern Xinjiang shows a security regime that's just more draconian than, as you say, nearly anything else that that we've seen in the world, really. Certainly more than anything I recall reading about in recent years. Let's talk about the extent of state coercion in Xinjiang and how it really seems to have accelerated under Cheng Quanguo, who has been the Communist Party secretary, in other words, the most powerful official of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region since 2016. Tell us about Chen, about his background, and especially about his work in Tibet, and the grid policing system that he implemented there, and what his approach has been in Xinjiang since taking the top party post there.
So Chen ascended to this position after rolling out his so-called grid policing style in Tibet, and by all accounts, you know, has been considered a successful manager of this Tibetan issue after basically blanketing the streets with police. You know, the incidents of kind of self-immolations, that at least the ones that we hear about, have gone down. You know, he came after a period of about 5 years in which the previous party secretary in Xinjiang rolled out a lot of what could be viewed as carrot initiatives to basically win over the hearts and minds of Uyghurs. These were sort of, you know, money rewards for intermarriage and things like that, that I think within the party were seen as a bit too soft on this issue. You know, Xinjiang, of course, was rocked by attacks in Urumqi. There was the Kunming bus attack, and I think the gist was that they needed kind of a hard man to come in to, you know, let's use the stick a bit more. And Chen Quanguo, by all accounts, have absolutely delivered on that.
Can you give us a sense of exactly how heavy the police presence is in terms of the increased budget for security, the police density, the feeling when you walk around on the streets of, say, Urumqi or Kashgar, Kashgar or Ili or Khotan? How does it feel? How are there numbers? How do we understand how invasive or pervasive the police presence is?
And it's not Xinjiang wide, right? I mean, Urumqi is very different from Korla, where you are or where you were, right?
Yeah, there's absolutely a spectrum here. But let me just try to give you a picture of what it's like to sort of, you know, be on the streets. I mean, it's so incredibly pervasive that it does feel like a kind of a constant state of war. So if you're walking down the street in a place like Khotan, maybe about once every two blocks, there will be a checkpoint where you have to get out of your car because somebody will come and look in the trunk, somebody will come and look under the car. You have to line up and give your ID and possibly submit to a check of your smartphone. There are banners all over the streets. There are walking patrols. And then once every few hours, there will also be these large cavalcades of you know, more than 30 maybe 40 armored vehicles, some filled with paramilitary troops. And on, you know, just basically all along the street is just everywhere you see billboards that say, you know, Comrade Xi Jinping stands with you. Let's all work together for ethnic unity. I mean, this stuff is, you know, in terms of sight, in terms of sound, it's absolutely ubiquitous, and it sort of really is.
Jerry, give me a sense of the ethnic composition of the actual patrols, for example, or of the actual cops, the people who are stopping you and searching your trunk and asking you to produce ID. Are these Uyghurs or are they Han, or is it indeterminate?
There is an interesting composition here. I think almost all of the frontline sort of security workers, so the police that stop you, that check for ID, they're all Uyghurs. And then usually their superiors are Han.
Interesting. And it's not really just police stations or checkpoints and security cameras, right? I mean, it's also this biometric stuff, including, I mean, your story is talking about taking DNA samples and doing very sophisticated facial recognition, too. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, for the last year or so, there have been reports that that there has been widespread DNA collection. And I thought that maybe it would just be a portion of the population. When I arrived in Kashgar, actually it was before that. I was in Hotan, and I had heard from some local officials about these what they described as services for the people. It's health checks. It's and if you walk through the main bazaar in Hotan, there's actually a recording that's played on loudspeakers just over and over and over again, asking people to submit to these health checks for their own good. And then, you know, pretty quickly I realized that, you know, they did indeed take blood samples and that this was being done essentially region-wide.
Oh my God.
Jerry, is it all stick now and no more carrot at all? I mean, are there no more inducements towards assimilation and that sort of thing? And have they been at all successful in creating party loyalists among Uyghurs in Xinjiang?
I think that, you know, the carrot absolutely has continued. I couldn't tell you the specifics of, you know, for example, the marriage incentives. But, you know, I certainly do think that the party has tried very much, you know, to alleviate rural poverty in Xinjiang, perhaps more so than even the rest of China, and it has been a leading incentive. And I think if you talk to many of the officials, they sort of feel a bit frustrated. You know, why isn't there more attention that's being paid to all the things that we've done for the rural poor, for the elderly, and that, you know, the economic development is the first and the best way to sort of assuage some of these sources of discontent among the Uyghurs.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Probably the most disturbing thing that you wrote about, though, are these detention or, euphemistically, vocational training centers, like the one in Korla where you reported. Actually, I think there were more than just one. How close did you get to these, and what were people able to tell you about conditions inside them, about what actually goes on inside the walls of these detention centers? And what does one have to do to find oneself behind such walls?
They seem to be incredibly ubiquitous. I mean, you know, I tried to pin down the numbers of people that have been sent in. There have been reports that in some villages there have been even quotas. So let's say 20%, 30%, 40% of an entire village's population that needs to be sort of rotated in and out of these, you know, re-education centers.
Okay.
You know, they seem to be pretty well known. You know, when I was traveling in, let's say, Korla, people basically seemed to know, you know, where they were. It wasn't much of a secret. You know, one of the centers that I visited essentially was just a kanchosu. I mean, it was basically just a detention center. It was basically a jail. You know, I have heard of others that sort of, you know, are more nondescript buildings. We've gleaned from the state media's own reports that these are essentially locked dormitories in which Uyghurs stay for months to sort of read over patriotic materials, things that kind of teach them about all the things that the party has done for the Uyghurs, the signs that they should look out for amongst their friends and their relatives of possibly extremist thought, if anybody is talking to people overseas, if anybody has kept a beard, for example. You know, these are all warning signs. And
Jeremy, you have a beard.
Yeah, no. But I was going to say, it reminds me a little bit of when I was in primary school in the apartheid era in South Africa. We were white school children were forced to go to a thing called Veld School, which means like bush school. And we got lectures on things like the evils of blue jeans and how if you wore denim jeans, you were kind of a communist, but also maybe an American Satanist. And it was only a week. and we were, you know, more or less voluntary. But it's sort of a similar kind of program of indoctrination, I guess. Jerry, do you have a sense of how many people have been sent to these things?
So in Korla, people told me that it was, you know, let's say about 4,000, possibly more. And if you were to kind of extrapolate that in every village, in all the other major cities, it could be tens of thousands. It could be possibly far more than that. It's really hard to say. But and I think the biggest issue here is the lack of transparency. I tried to capture in my story, which is this sense of, it's really kind of the sense of uncertainty that's what's most devastating, I think, because, you know, a lot of times these people, these Uyghurs, young and old, they range anywhere from essentially teenagers to older people in their 70s. They can be sort of asked to leave, taken away suddenly and without any sort of official court notices. It's an extrajudicial process.
Right.
Family members, meanwhile, who are outside, don't have any sense of, you know, how long they're going to be inside. And that number, by the way, we sort of estimate is anywhere between, let's say, 2 to 3 months to several years, could be. They don't know what the situation of their loved ones are. And we found the instance of one family, which I had originally heard about from overseas sources, that there was a young man in Korla. He was taken away back in February of 2017. And when we arrived, and we had heard that he had actually died under unknown and mysterious circumstances while in detention. And when we arrived at his mother's home in November, she had actually had no idea whether he was dead or alive, and she hadn't heard of anything.
That was the very sad kicker to that piece, yeah.
And that does also mean that my comparison to my week in Felt School in South Africa is completely ridiculous.
But I think there are other meaningful comparisons that you can make.
Well, the propaganda aspect, the sort of brainwashing aspect, I think is a meaningful comparison. But I mean, this is much more akin to some kind of gulag than it is to, you know, what I was talking about.
Right.
This is, you know, if people are sent away for, you know, possibly years, and there's absolutely no sense of why they're there and how long they'll be there, that is a pretty extreme situation.
So the interesting thing here is that actually this program, as far as I can tell, has been going back several years. But before, let's say 2-3 years ago, people would be invited to come in. They would sit for half a day, and then at night go home and have dinner with their families, go to sleep, and then maybe they would do this for, you know, several weeks. How this rapidly ratcheted up into this far more draconian and you know, slightly nightmarish kind of version, I can't pretend to know what was the thinking inside the local officials' minds, but, you know, it does reflect this broader phenomenon we're seeing, which is that all of these measures are just being ratcheted up so fast, and the process seems to be accelerating.
And is it local officials, or is this Chen Chuanguo? I mean, Chen Chuanguo's tenure there started in 2016, and it seems to maybe correspond to this ratcheting up that you're talking about. Anyway, I guess we don't really know. Jerry, though, is your sense that this separatism, the separatist sentiment that they're trying to eradicate, whether or not it's actually stiffened by global jihadism, which is something that the Chinese state, you know, really wants to claim, is this something they can break? Is this something they can stamp out? I mean, maybe it's just the American in me, but it just seems like the Chinese officialdom must suspect in their heart of hearts that not only are they going to fail to eradicate it, but it's only going to deepen the already quite bitter resentment that they have. I can't see how this works. I mean, Tibet is a different case, maybe. What's your sense? Can this work?
This issue is something that is basically the nut of the series of articles I wrote, is exploring this idea of whether, you know, some of these heavy-handed measures are exacerbating what has frankly been a decades-long separatist movement. I mean, the idea of the formation of a Uyghur state goes back, you know, practically a century.
Right.
This idea, you know, is so old, it's probably not going to ever go away. But when we are living in this kind of more interconnected world of the internet, when you have militant groups in the Middle East, in Central Asia, that are able to sort of use the measures that the Chinese government is deploying in Xinjiang as a selling point to win more recruits, I mean, that does raise the question of, is this only making things worse?
Right.
Jerry, can I go back to your first piece, which focuses on the security measures? You talked to a Uyghur who left China after 2009, the riots in Urumqi and the subsequent clampdown. He is currently in Washington, and he told you about the pressure his family back in Xinjiang has come under. What's more, he told you that he's been accosted by a Uyghur official over WhatsApp, of all things, and he was basically told that he has to cooperate. Is this something you're hearing a lot about, Beijing reaching beyond China's borders to try and control Uyghurs in the diaspora?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do know that China is increasingly using its political, economic influence to convince countries like Thailand or even Turkey to view the security situation as its own issue, as a priority to help detain and deport Uyghurs who have left China. And I guess, you know, in the last couple of years, I would say, we have seen these instances of officials directly reaching out to Uyghurs who have left the country. This anecdote that I heard was particularly interesting because, you know, it almost seemed as if this official in the International Cooperation Department of the regional PSB, I mean, he sort of almost wanted to flip the situation and say, hey, if you, this Uyghur scholar who had fled China, if you refuse to come back, if you refuse to sort of submit yourself to our questioning and prove your loyalty to the Chinese state, you can prove it to us by essentially spying for us. I mean, that was the subtext of what he was trying to say. You're well-placed in Washington. Maybe we can turn this kind of disagreeable situation into something that benefits us both.
It wasn't a veiled threat against his family?
It was absolutely a veiled threat against his family.
Yeah, that's how I read it, yeah.
But it was also an inducement, a proposal of good treatment.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the fundamental fear that a lot of Uyghurs abroad have, is that, you know, because they have so much family back in Xinjiang, that, you know, that is always something that can be used as leverage against them. And so there is this kind of self-enforced veil of silence, essentially, because any sort of contact that they might have with family members back in Xinjiang could lead their relatives into trouble. It's better for them to just not have any contact at all. And so they don't know. There's no way for them to say happy birthday. There's no way for them to find out if a relative has been led away to re-education. There's no way for them to even know what the status of their children is, how they're doing, whether they're healthy, whether they're sick. It's completely shut off.
Right. There's that heartbreaking anecdote about him calling his daughter back and then finally, you know, summoning up the courage to call her, and she picks up and just says, "Mom's here." She doesn't want to talk to you, and then hangs up. Right.
Right.
Jerry, you've written about how even relatively mild critics of the government are now being cracked down on, with pretty harsh prison sentences being handed down. I think many of our listeners are going to be familiar with the scholar Ilham Tohti, who was at the Minzu Dasyue, but few are going to know about this guy, Zhang Haitao, who wasn't exactly a prominent activist, and he is himself actually Han. So tell us about Zhang Haitao, what he did and what he's alleged to have done, and how he was punished.
So Zhang, he was a Han. I think he was maybe in his late 40s. You know, he's originally from Henan, and he's a low-level telecom salesman. You know, he would go around selling wireless routers, things like that, in Urumqi, where he moved to seek kind of better job prospects. And then, you know, at night, he would log on to Twitter, which is, of course, blocked inside China. But he would log on to Twitter and sort of just mouth off, you know.
So he had a VPN, huh?
Yeah, exactly. He had VPN. He knew his internet, you know, technology. But you know, he shot off maybe about, I think it was a total of more than 200 tweets off into the digital ether. I mean, he didn't have a whole lot of followers. And I guess the contrast I wanted to make here is, you know, you had Ilham Tohti. He was widely respected, and you know, you could argue almost internationally famous. Here we had a case of a guy who just basically had, I don't know, maybe a few hundred, if that, followers on Twitter. It wasn't really particularly kind of, you know, profound analysis of some of these, you know, ethnic policy issues. He was just mouthing off, you know, oh, you know, it's terrible what I'm seeing here. The Communist Party is a bunch of thieves. This, I mean, it's almost a little bit kind of amateuristic, kind of, you know, off the cuff remarks. And for this, he got a total of,
it was like 11 years or something.
Far more than that. Yeah, it was closer to 20 years. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Wow.
I mean, is it your sense that there are Han Chinese, besides him, I mean, who are sympathetic with the way that Uyghurs have been treated? Or does the indifference or even actually the hostility and the fear that is quite, you know, frankly, commonplace among Han Chinese that I know, so overpower the sympathy that functionally there's basically no support for Uyghurs from the Han population at large, besides this poor guy Zhang Haital.
You guys probably have a good sense of this. I mean, so I actually am fascinated by this issue because I did a story earlier in 2017 about this rising Islamophobia.
Sure.
In China, and I guess this kind of like Han nationalism. I think a lot of it stems from, I guess, you know, which is what you see in the news every day, you know, is bombs going off in the Middle East and ISIS. And I think that seeps into the kind of the popular Chinese consciousness. And on Weibo, on Weixing, I mean, the level of kind of, you know, antipathy towards the Muslims in China is significant. There's been numerous and well-documented social media campaigns about, you know, why does CCTV and its New Year's broadcast, for example, not mention pork? Is it because they're afraid of offending Muslims? Why is it that Air China doesn't serve pork on certain flights, you know, to in and out of Xinjiang, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? I think that the level of sympathy towards the Uyghurs that you would see from somebody like Zhang Haitao is certainly in the minority in China.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we did a show actually with Alice Su, who did a splendid report about that. We did a show with her, and I would refer listeners to talk about rising Islamophobia, and it's a very, very big problem. I think it's definitely been exacerbated. I think there's sort of a permission that's been given for the same kind of politically incorrect behavior in China that actually emanates from our country, from the U.S. Hey, cynical listeners. I want to thank our sponsor, Casper Mattresses, really quick, and let you know that we've got a terrific promotion for you to help you get a good night's sleep and save big bucks. Get a Casper mattress delivered to your door for free with their wonderful 100-night risk-free sleep on it trial return policy, and save $50. All you need to do to save $50 on a select Casper mattress is visit casper.com/supchina and use the promo code supchina, SUPCHINA, at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Pleasant dreams. And now back to the show.
And on a slightly different topic, Jerry, you were detained in Kuala for 11 hours. So I have that in common with you. I was detained in Kuala for 4 hours. Can you tell us about your detention?
Well, I mean, how was the tea they offered you? You know, maybe we can, you know, compare notes.
It wasn't great. I was just asked to leave.
Can you tell us about that?
In the course of reporting about this young man, this young student who returned from Egypt, and we believed died during detention. So we spoke to his mother briefly. She initially sort of was extremely curious about what we knew about him and really wanted to know, and then kind of soon realized that it just the risks were too great to talk to foreign media, and so we left. And then I kept pushing inside of this village to ask other people sort of what they knew about him, his fate. What was he like? One of the people I spoke to essentially then snitched and took me to the local cops, who then took me back to Korla, and then that, and you know, sort of got drawn out into a very long period of detention. And they essentially told us that, you know, why do you foreign journalists always focus on security measures? You know, why don't you ever write about the good things? You know, sort of quite typical things. And then, and there's basically a long period in which we were interrogated repeatedly about where we had been, who we had spoken to. And
then what did they do, Jerry? Did they just run you out of town and force you to go back to Urumqi? What was the outcome of it?
In the end, we took a 5:30 a.m. Train to Urumqi. They saw us onto the train, and that's that.
Bye-bye, Lenina. So let us shift now completely and talk about some of the reporting that you did from Turkey about the Uyghurs in exile, the diaspora, and the struggle within the Uyghur community in Turkey over radicalization. You know, this is fascinating. I don't think I've read anything about this that has been reported in the depth that you've done. The Uyghur community abroad, especially in Turkey. How did you find the people who'd fought in Syria? And how did they regard you? An American, obviously, but also, you know, clearly of Han Chinese ethnicity and based in Beijing.
Sure. I guess it was incredibly striking, two things, both of which you kind of touched on. One was the fact that when I arrived in Turkey, you know, I had a few contacts, and then, you know, we basically met up with former fighters. You know, a lot of it was friends of friends. Some of it was, you know, talking to community leaders who introduced us. It was really striking how many people had gone, or how many people had known somebody who had gone. And it was almost casual. You know, you're sitting outside a kebab shop talking to somebody, and he's like, "Oh yeah, yeah, you know, I actually had an uncle and two nephews, a cousin who went over there." It was always they went over there to just check it out. You know, a lot of it, and others were sort of, you know, far more angry. They had really wanted to do this, but it was to me kind of how should I say, maybe almost an open secret. And I was just shocked. I said, why hasn't this been, I guess, reported more previously? And you know, the only answers I could come up with were A, it is Turkey. Most of the reporters who are covering the Uyghur issue are based in Beijing, and Turkey is halfway across the world. And B, I think that, to be completely honest, there has been a lot of skepticism, as there should be, of the Chinese government's claims for many, many years that there is actually this phenomenon of thousands of Uyghurs joining militants in Syria. And I think that sort of the typical skepticism that non-Chinese academics and media have towards the Chinese government statements such as this probably slowed us down in terms of actually taking this seriously and looking into this.
And Jerry, I suppose that's why your reporting on this struck Kaiser and me so forcefully, because I do think, you know, you have done something that nobody's done before, which is look seriously at this with an unjaundiced eye. You've just gone and talked to people and found that this is a real thing without going there with the agenda of calling them terrorists.
So I guess and this brings up an interesting point, which is I was wondering, you know, what the Uyghur community there, what their response would be to somebody like me, as you say, a kind of an ethnic Chinese American journalist showing up and talking to them about something uncomfortable. And in many instances, they actually were happy. You know, some of these Uyghur leaguers or some of these Uyghur intellectuals, they were thrilled that somebody was coming to look at this issue, because this kind of debate, it has been more or less an open debate, but within a very cloistered community, about, you know, that this is a scourge. This is something that we need to address head on. And it doesn't help anybody if we don't tackle this issue head on.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I thought was really interesting was that there is another participant in that conversation, and that's, of course, the Uyghur activist groups. And they've generally really tried to play down this idea that there's any kind of a connection between global jihadism and Uyghur separatism. They've kind of encouraged the academic community that you kind of made reference to in that an almost denial of this. I have to imagine that the way the party leaders in Beijing or in even Urumqi have greeted your reporting, it's got to be pretty conflicted. I mean, they can't be happy about you reporting on the Orwellian policing, but then the pieces that you reported from Turkey, I have to think they're almost happy to see a reputable Western news source confirming that there's this separatist party, the very existence of which some Western experts have questioned, is in cahoots with real bad guys. So has the foreign ministry asked you to tea yet? Have you talked to them about this yet?
No, I haven't gotten any sort of official response. I can, you know, somebody sent me this article on WeChat. It was a Chinese military affairs blogger. They basically translated some of my stories and wrote this extended blog post saying, okay, here is a, you know, international, it's AP, it's an international media. They looked at this issue of Uyghur militancy and separatism through a very politically biased lens. However, it confirms some of the things that the Chinese government has been saying, Right. And right. so, and then that's my point. Right. That was up there on the internet for about, I don't know, maybe 48 hours max before it was censored. So I actually have no idea, you know, what the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, what state security, what you know, the defense ministry thinks. My suspicion, for example, of why a blog post like that was, sorry, a Weibo post like that was taken down was that I'm not sure how much awareness there is in Xinjiang due to censorship there is of the existence of these groups. For instance, one of the fighters I had met from Hotan, he had no idea that there were these Uyghur separatists or militants or what the ETIM or what the TIP was until he one day saw on state media in a state newspaper about the death of one of its leaders. And then it sort of planted the seed in his head. He sort of, you know, looked on the internet and started receiving information from apps, you know, WhatsApp, Voxer, Viber, Telegram. And that sort of, you know, was what kind of started him on this path towards radicalization. In my reporting, I didn't find anybody who said, okay, you know, this is a mosque that's kind of like a, you know, a jihadi factory, or this is kind of the network of recruiters. You know, all of it was either they had basically been recruited after they left China, or they were kind of looped into this by the use of messaging apps, which could explain why a lot of these apps were starting to get shut down one by one during that period of 2013, I think 2014.
And the real worry is what happens to them once they go home to China, right?
Yeah.
They bring that training with them and that militancy. What's your expectation there? Do you think that China is in for, you know, really serious incidents of terrorism, of major violent episodes?
Or to put it in another way that I was about to ask before Kaiser said that, how f***ed is Xinjiang?
It's kind of
pretty.
It's hard to see how this ends, I suppose, you know, whether this cycle is just going to keep getting worse or whether, you know, Chen Qianguo really is going to prevail after 5 years of just absolutely suffocating security. I mean, that's what the, you know, Party Central is essentially banking on, right? I mean, if we can just kind of squeeze the life out of any sort of resistance, then eventually we'll have peace. But you have thousands of these guys who are outside of the country now in places where China can't reach. They're plotting their next move. Some of these fighters said, there's Obor, One Belt, One Road. It has projects, it's Chinese projects with a target painted on it all over the world. China can't be everywhere. Its security can't be everywhere.
These guys now have connections to jihadists with bombs and drones and skills.
Yeah, there were reports that. Do you guys remember the embassy, Chinese embassy in Bishkek was targeted by kind of a dud of a suicide attack. But the Kyrgyz security forces reportedly had said that the entire plot was financed by Nusra. I haven't looked into that. I can't confirm it independently, but for what it's worth, that was what they said.
So I want to find out more about who these Uyghurs are. I mean, I know China claims that there have been Uyghurs training with the Taliban and working with Al-Qaeda since, you know, well before September 11th. And the Uyghurs, though, that you've talked to who joined the fight against Bashar al-Assad, they're much younger, obviously. But are they sort of part of a continuous presence of Uyghurs since the late 90s, maybe, following on the wave of violence in southern Xinjiang in, what, 97, I guess that was? Or is this like a separate wave, maybe a post-2009 wave? And is there sort of a marked difference between these two maybe generations of Uyghurs in the diaspora?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that in the 1990s, there had been maybe hundreds. I really don't know the exact number of Uyghurs who had been embedded with the Taliban. You know, there was a Uyghur militant leader who sat on the Al-Qaeda Shura Council. And you can draw a straight line, you know, between some of those early Uyghur separatists that kind of got bedded in with these international, transnational jihadi groups to the thousands that we're seeing in Syria today. The only difference is that I think, you know, yes, some of those leaders relocated from Afghanistan and Pakistan to Syria, but in the 90s, in the 2000s, they really were kind of a skeleton force. You know, they were pumping out propaganda videos occasionally, but they were pretty emasculated. I mean, you know, going back into the 90s, you had Osama bin Laden saying that, you know, we shouldn't piss off China. Let's not back any sort of actions against this rising power whose mutual enemy is with us is the United States. Also, Mullah Omar, I think, you know, according to the Taliban spokesperson's memoirs, also personally guaranteed the Chinese that no attacks on China would be launched from Afghanistan. And so you had this period of, let's say, you know, 10, 20 years where they had no followers, they had no substantial backers in the forms of, you know, Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. And finally, this Syria war happens. It presents this opening. It coincides with thousands, maybe more than 10,000 Uyghurs leaving China. And suddenly just presents, you know, in the wake of this massive security crackdown in Xinjiang. And it's just
right,
kind
so
of
it's a, like a push and a pull at the same time then, right? So there's the push element of China cracking down and this sort of pull element of the you know, maybe wanting to go to support the so-called caliphate, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a confluence. It's like a perfect storm of factors. I mean, for the first time, these guys who've been, you know, kind of helplessly just hanging out in Afghanistan, now they suddenly have this stage where they can call thousands of Uyghurs to their side and become an actual serious fighting force.
And what is their reputation as a fighting force? The Uyghurs have gone to Syria. Have they been seen as effective?
Very much so. And this is one of the interesting things is my colleague in Beirut, who had been covering the Syrian war closely. And you know, one day last year, he sends me an email and he's like, hey, you know, my sources in some of the militias, they've been telling me that, you know, who are these guys from China who are really sort of making a splash on the battlefield? They've kind of really been unsettling Assad's, you know, the loyalist army with their suicide attacks. And some of them have been really kind of gung-ho, you know, charging into the front lines. And they're from China. I mean, they don't speak Arabic. What's the deal? And then, you know, I had, of course, been following the story from China, but it was that moment was kind of when I was thinking, man, this is something that really should be taken a closer look at.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Do you think, Jerry, that they are losing the moderate Uyghurs in the diaspora? Are they losing the de-radicalization battle, as one of your sources lamented?
Yeah, that was the thrust of kind of, you know, one of the stories that I wrote was, you know, in this period when you had groups like the Turkestan Islamic Party putting out slick propaganda videos on YouTube with emotional music and, you know, open season recruiting that's going on in Turkey, how do this older generation of the diaspora's leaders, you know, your World Uyghur Congress, who advocate, you know, political dialogue, more autonomy, non-violent means. How do they still make sure that they get their voice heard? And I think that it was quite striking that the frustration that I would hear from people who were, in fact, kind of high-level officials, you know, vice presidents of the WUC, who said that, you know, we're afraid we're losing this younger generation of frustrated young men.
Wow, that's fascinating. There was one Uyghur man that you talked to in Istanbul who says that it's happening just like it did in the 1980s. There were some Uyghurs who entered Afghanistan via the Wakhan corridor, that tiny little narrow corridor that attaches Afghanistan to China, and was kind of an artifact of the great game. And they joined up with the Mujahideen in the fight against Soviet occupation, and then presumably later hooked up with the Taliban or with Al-Qaeda. And he says that this, I think if I'm paraphrasing him correctly, he basically that it just gave Beijing a reason to crack down on the Uyghurs. And this is a guy who had spent 14 years in prison. So my sense from your story is that there's, You know, these older guys are really, you know, there's some wisdom in what they're saying, that these younger dudes who are showing up and signing on with these Salafist groups and pursuing armed jihad, they're just gonna make things worse. Is that a view that you share?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, so this idea that you mention of this kind of fear amongst the community elders that this phenomenon of their young men becoming radicalized is bad for their international image and is only exacerbating the crackdown in Xinjiang. This is, you hear this, you know, everywhere. In fact, there's actually a conspiracy theory that I've heard repeated several times among the Uyghur diaspora that this entire phenomenon is actually a massive Chinese conspiracy.
I'm not surprised,
you know,
they've.
I personally don't buy, but you know, the idea is that, oh, okay, well, why did China open its borders or at least not close its borders, you know, for more than a year in 2012, 2013, and how did all these people end up in Syria? You know, they must have sort of, you know, been with a wink and a nod from the Chinese. That, I think there's not a lot of evidence to support that, but it does point to the level of frustration that some of these community leaders feel, that this is so damaging to our cause that it must be a Chinese government conspiracy.
But on the other side, Jerry, is China at all correct when it asserts a connection between, or in some cases conflates, Uyghur independence activists and full-blown jihadists?
I think that China has consistently tied the two things and conflated the two things, but the point of one of my stories talking to some of these former fighters was to point out that, at least in their minds, it's not the same thing. Many of them went motivated by anger towards China,
right,
and their support for Uyghur independence or greater autonomy. You know, a lot of these guys don't believe in a vision of Islam a millennium ago. I don't think they believe in, you know, widespread Sharia law.
It's a revenge, not holy war, was, I think. Right. I don't know if you wrote that header, but one of your editors perhaps wrote it. It was, they're seeking revenge. They're not actually engaged in a religious conflict.
Right, right. And in fact, two fighters told me that they would actually be sort of debating this very issue often amongst themselves. You know, some of these militant leaders, kind of the hardened fighters who had been fighting alongside Nusra or some of these other groups, they would say, look, it's our duty as Muslims to sort of wage this war against Assad and to stick with this fight. And then some of the newer guys who came in would say, well, look, all we want is to just get revenge against China. It's not about a holy war. It's not about jihad. When are we going to go back and attack China? And so that there was that very much that sort of, you know, source of tension within the groups itself.
I wanted to ask you one more thing. So much of what we read about Xinjiang in the English press, your reporting aside, and stuff that your colleagues at AP have done. I mean, I've seen some great stuff back. You know, Gillian Wong a few years ago did a really great piece out there. But a lot of it comes from RFA or from Uyghur activist groups. What's a good way for us to approach those claims? I mean, it's very hard for me to tell what's being enforced in one city or town and what the whole, you know, region might be doing. I can't get a good sense of how well sourced these stories are. What's your approach to news outlets like RFA?
In my personal experience, a lot of times I have personally confirmed the reports that RFA has put out. I think that I think that RFA, I don't doubt the accuracy of the reporting. I think that, okay. Yeah, I don't think that, you know, it's fake news. Let's put it that way. Are they reporting the most sort of kind of heinous or shocking aspects of what's happening in a certain place? Sure. But I mean, you know, I guess media in many cases do that. I mean, I wouldn't question their sort of journalistic ethics.
Great, great, great. Jerry, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I mean, this is an absolutely fascinating series, and my money's actually on you for a Pulitzer for this.
Yeah, right.
No, I mean, it's an excellent series. It was really quite groundbreaking. So stick around. Let's make a recommendation or two. Before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina. Sign up for our free email newsletter and buy our terrific red paper on the important China news in 2017. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter, where our handle is SupChina News. And if you like the Seneca Podcast, by all means, please go and leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store. It does mean a lot to us and helps other people to discover the podcast. Now, on to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off.
I'm going to be a little boring today and recommend something that I have recommended before and something to do with somebody who's actually been a guest on our show before. And I know you, as an American red-blooded male, scoff at my sort of Commonwealth birdwatching activities, but I would like to recommend birdingbeijing.com, a great site if you're interested in birds in China. And one that has been tracking some really interesting projects. They're now in the second year of tracking cuckoos who migrate from Beijing to Africa, some of them reaching all the way to Southern Africa, Namibia, and my home country of South Africa. So
yeah, we've done a whole show on that.
We have, yeah. But it's just, there's been some interesting stuff on birding Beijing recently. So that is my recommendation, and on with you.
Great. Jerry, you're up next. What do you have for us?
Sure. I would recommend anybody who's interested in the subject and China and its history with, Islamic militancy to read the China-Pakistan Axis. It's a book by Andrew Small. He's a researcher at the German Marshall Fund of the United States in Washington. And this book explores sort of China's security concerns, China's history with Pakistan, and a large component of this, of course, is kind of China's competition with India. The other part of it is, the entire Uyghur issue and some of the history. It's absolutely fantastic. Andrew is, he knows this stuff inside out. Read this book, especially with Belt and Road as such like a big issue now in the news and the China-Pakistan relationship. To me, it's a must-read.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm definitely going to do that.
Thanks, Jerry. Fantastic.
I am going to recommend a noble, very bold, but I fear ultimately doomed endeavor of a website called Kialo.com, Kialo.com. It's a place for online debate that's supposed to help people on opposite sides of issues, the big weighty issues, frivolous ones too, ones about movies and things like that. But really, mainly it's big political issues or social or ethical issues to be able to debate more constructively. Wonderfully earnest and naive about it.
You're so cute, Kaiser. Sweetheart.
Well, so how it works is you click Kumbaya. On, there's hundreds of issues. I know. We'll all hold hands and sing. It's organized around these assertions, and there's this kind of tree of arguments, pro and con, and each is kind of on a little card, and then it has sub-arguments debating its merits in the same way. And so you're limited in the number of words that you can write on to each of them. It's 500 words, so it really kind of urges you to be more succinct, to be terse. And the community votes on the cards with the more compelling arguments, so that when you actually look at it, you see the arguments that have sort of floated up to the top that are the more compelling ones, pro and con for a particular claim. The problem, okay, so I mean, there's no ad hominem attack. There's a kind of insistence on this kind of logic and evidence based style of argumentation, and the problem, of course, is that anyone who comes so far as to accepting these ground rules is just not the kind of person that we have a problem with today. Instead, the people we have a problem with are the people who are like on the other side of this freaking epistemic divide from us, who reject the whole idea of truth, the post-truth people, or of expertise, or of logical argument. Anyway, I got to applaud the effort. Jeremy, you can laugh at me all you want, but I do encourage you to check it out. I was a member of a similar community before called Parleo. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I know. Very worthy. Very worthy.
You can laugh at me all you want, but I like to...
I'm applauding you, Kaiser. Can't you hear?
I know. Jerry... Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. Sure. That's fantastic. I mean, really, what a great series. Such an informative look at something that I really think has not got enough attention in a serious way, and you've put a spotlight on it, which I think is extremely valuable.
in a laudably dispassionate way, but yeah, I mean, bringing in ample context and shading it in all properly. So congrats.
Well, yeah, I mean, you guys, yeah, it's the highest praise coming from you two. So thanks a lot. It's flattering. Yeah.
Okay. We'll see you soon, Jeremy. I'm going to take it out.
Let's hope flattery gets us everywhere.
The Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina and is produced by Kaiser Gula and Jeremy Goldcorn. Drop us an email at cynica@supchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/supchinanews and follow us on Twitter at supchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.